Obama once said, every man is trying to live up to his father's expectations or make up for their father's mistakes. How common is this amongst the high-performing men you've worked with?
It's probably 100%. I would say, wow. I would say Obama was spot on when he made that very, very astute observation that men are always looking, see, highly successful men, driven men, men are looking, who are looking to make a difference in the world, are looking to fulfill other people's shoes and need a role model. And typically that's their own father.
Mm. I think personally, I'm living up to my father's expectations and his mistakes. And is this also the case for you, do you think?
I think so. I think for me, it's been looking for my father's approval, that my father and I didn't really get on very well in the early parts of our lives. I was working with a family the other day, and the father said, talking of his son, that we're like oil and water. And I thought, well, gee, that's quite similar to my father and I, that we were very different in terms of our view of masculinity, in terms of our temperament. And it really wasn't until I became, got a PhD and became successful in my career, and he was starting to see me on the news and things like that, where he took pride in me. And while we didn't have a good coming up, we had a very good ending, and we were able to make peace with each other and have some meaningful conversations.
Yeah. And why do you think there is this almost, not, I wouldn't say almost like fundamental, but almost fundamental misunderstanding between the father and the son? You know, my father is really supportive and we get along really well, but there are still some just misunderstandings. And like you were saying about the PhD and him kind of, you know, almost approving you once you've got this recognition. Why is there that difference?
Because I think that as sons, we're a reflection of our father's egos. And so it's more about the ego and how we mirror back where they are in the world. And this is really acute amongst high-performing, successful, wealthy families, because having an identity of wealth is a cultural identity similar to race or religion or gender. And there are certain expectations that are attendant in that identity. And I think that our fathers, if they are part of that, if they do have this identity of self, that they want to see themselves reflected back in their children, in their sons in particular.
Yeah. And that kind of makes me think of the quote, the story of the father is embedded in the son. And did he want you to become a psychiatrist and a psychologist, or was there some tension with that?
Well, I think, you know, I have a rather rocky, like, I wasn't a direct line. I didn't go exactly from uni to becoming a psychologist. I became a lawyer, and that was my first career. And I think that he was proud of that. My father put himself through uni. He was a working class person. He realized that education was important. It was important for him to send my brother and me to a private university and to have that experience. He didn't have that experience. I think it took him 14 years to get his undergraduate degree.
Wow.
And he worked full time and raised our family and went to night school. And so it was very important for him to instill that sense of higher education and work ethic in us. And I became a lawyer in my first career. And then I realized that was inconsistent with who I was on a number of different levels. Like, living in a state of conflict was not how I wanted to live my life. And so I left the practice of law somewhat ingloriously. I was terminated from a fancy law firm. And
wow.
I kind of banged around for a number of years trying to figure out what I wanted to do. And I went into the field of philanthropy. And my last job was with Greenpeace International in Amsterdam. And then September 11th happened, and I'm American, and as a white male American who lived, the security of my world had been guaranteed until that happened, and I had an existential crisis, and I moved back to America, and that's when I started studying psychology, first as a master's, and then as a PhD, and I think he was worried. I think that during that period where I was cast about, that he was worried, and so once I found my place in the world and found an identity and found a career that was congruent with who I am and what I wanted, value that I wanted to provide in the world, I think he had a huge sense of relief, as did I. So I think that that he was happy that it all sorted in the end. And I think the lesson is, well, hopefully this is the end. Hopefully there's still more to go.
Yeah.
At the same time, that it is a journey, and that I think finding oneself and finding one's place in the world, it can be a nonlinear process. It was certainly that for me.
Definitely. And what are some of the things that you learned from being at that inflection point? Maybe not, I don't know if it was rock bottom for you, but where you...
It was rock bottom.
Yeah. What was that like, and how did you learn from it and improve?
Well, it was quite hard and it was quite dark. It was a struggle. And what it proved to me was, I had spent my life thinking that success was a place, and that I had known people who had attained enormous success in show business and in the internet, and they had done these things. And I thought that success was a thing, it was a place. And then I realized that for me, that it wasn't a goal, it wasn't necessarily a place, but it was a process. And it was this process of self-discovery and self-healing, and that it was the journey of self-discovery and learning. We were talking a bit earlier, and you mentioned how you're curious, and the reason why you got into this work is out of curiosity. And I think it's important to cultivate that sense of curiosity, curiosity of self, curiosity of others, curiosity of the world that we live in, and looking at how we can work towards increments of better in that process. It's tough, I think, for men in particular, because we're told that we need to be X, Y, and Z, and those are a finite place, and sort of cultivating a sense of curiosity, cultivating understanding, patience, and a process can be quite difficult.
Definitely. And you've worked with and treated these ultra high net worth and highly successful outliers, these, you know, I think, right, I heard you say these alpha Wall Street men. What's the common trait? What's the common thread you see amongst these high performers?
I see isolation. You know, I didn't start this work sort of with that intention. I started my work in a free clinic in Hollywood, working with HIV positive transgendered sex workers, people who lived in the margins of society in positions of powerlessness. And I also, at the same time, was working as a concierge lawyer for a super wealthy family. And there was some unresolved behavioral health issues. And I realized that there's two groups of human being who lived on the opposite ends of the power bell curve and were suffering from profound isolation and misunderstanding in those positions. The field of behavioral health, the field of mental health, had done a good job of studying people who live in positions of powerlessness and coming up with clinical formulations to deal with them in a very productive way. And yet this other group of people, this group of people who lived in the world in positions of extraordinary power, were suffering from faulty generalizations, right? We have all of these assumptions about who people of wealth are, and they're based upon negative stereotypes that, sure, a few people of power and wealth manifest, but not everybody. And there's this overgeneralization. And so my work really focuses on addressing the humanness that resides beneath stigmatized labels of other. And the need happened to be in people of wealth, because our society has a very schizophrenic view of people of wealth. We idolize them and we hate them.
Yeah.
Like all in the same breath. And it's super complicated. And like you being a curious person, I was like, there's something rich here. And I wanted to go deeper into it.
Definitely. And why do ultra successful people feel so isolated?
Because they're viewed as objects to be manipulated. That's the short answer. Once we realize that a person is a person of wealth, our whole perception of them changes. We think that they're narcissistic, that they're entitled, that they're selfish, that they're mean. And they may be, right? But not necessarily so. It isn't ipso facto. One isn't necessarily with the other. And so I think that's what it is. And And, you know, there's a biological component to this too, that we come out of the womb dependent upon other people's resources. And we contort ourselves as infants in all sorts of ways to get access to those resources. That doesn't necessarily change. Right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, when we think about applying for a job, right? You contort yourself to be the most attractive candidate and to present yourself in a way that is going to kind of manipulate the person who wants to hire you.
Yes.
And so we see this in families of wealth, where the person who controls the resources, the whole family orients themselves around, the whole system, the whole family gets oriented around that wealth, often in not such a healthy way. And so I look at myself when I had no business being a lawyer, but I wanted to be a lawyer because of what I thought the power, property, and the prestige that was associated with it. And that in my father's eyes, I would be successful and his investment in my uni would pay off. Now, mind you, I had no business being a lawyer because I don't like conflict and all that. But at the same time, that's an example from my life, and that's what happens. And it's hardwired into us biologically.
Yeah, I do wonder. I spend a lot of time thinking about how much I am, but also everyone else is dragged versus driven by their behaviors and their goals. You know, it's
right?
we love to think we're so rational, but a lot of the time we're actually just post-rationalizing what our deeper, you know, primal desires want to fulfill, right? And is that also the case for these highly successful people?
Everybody wants to be validated. Everybody wants to be seen and loved for their authenticity. That's hardwired into us. That's who we are. And sometimes when people feel a deficiency in themselves, they overcompensate by acquiring people, places, and things, by like objects. And they have experienced positions of powerlessness where they were victims or they were acted upon. And they were like, I'm never going to let that happen again. I'm going to be at the top of the heap because at the top of the heap, I can control what happens to me. It's brilliant. It's adaptive. You know, we certainly can't criticize people for that. Once they get to that place, though, then they start to realize that I need to diversify my portfolio, right? So I have all of these external markers of success. I have all this stuff. The stuff then starts to rule their lives. They get three cars, one of which is always broken down, right? And of course, they're exotic cars. So it is like they could just take them to the Toyota dealership. They have to take them to the Maserati dealership. And this car, they want a flatbed. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. And these things that they thought would give them freedom actually come to control them. And I am not here to say that capitalism is a bad thing. I think capitalism is a brilliant thing. I think capitalism and democracy, capitalism works in a lot of different political structures. I'm not here to say money's bad at all. That's not what I'm saying at all. I'm saying that it needs to be lived through an awareness of self, others, and the planet upon which we're privileged to live.
Mm. And if this desire for power, property, wealth, and status is intrinsic to the human condition, then why do people love to try and reject it for themselves and bring other people down? Like we were saying with the ultra successful people, a lot of, we see them, it's black and white. We either love them or we hate them and try and tear them back down. What are the reasons for that? What's the deeper meaning, the deeper human behavior behind that?
Well, it ties into Robert Greene's, one of his 48 Laws of Power, which is a brilliant book, is that reject the thing you cannot have.
Mm.
And so there is this, if I reject it, then I'm superior and better than. And I think we're seeing that in our society, in our culture. I just experienced that at one of America's most prestigious universities, where I was invited to participate in this program based upon my work as a cultural competency. And I sat in a week listening to how I need to be compassionate and empathetic to people who live in the world in positions of powerlessness. And then when I presented my work, I was rejected out of hand as a white, privileged white male. And I was like, this is the hypocrisy here. Yeah. Extraordinary. And it's cultural hypocrisy. It's like, wait a minute. We know, like through my research, I've identified three cultural markers of people of wealth: isolation, suspicion of outsiders, and hyperagency, which is the capacity to control your world to avoid discomfort. We talk about these human beings as the top 1%, the top 10%, right? So we know that there's a distinct group that has cultural markers, and yet you're telling me that this is outrageous and I can't do it. What do you mean I can't do this? The hypocrisy is extraordinary. I believe that culturally competent, clinically effective mental health services should be made available to every single human being, regardless of their place on the socioeconomic spectrum. So what you're telling me is that I can only provide cultural competent, clinically effective care to people who live in positions of our society in poverty and in the margins of powerlessness. No, that's not going to cut it, right? And so I think that, and by the way, I look at myself as a social justice advocate. I mean, I worked through Greenpeace, you know, I worked on behalf of the environment. And I think that the bottom up, like expecting rich people to do X, Y, and Z, it's not working. So, by the way, it's not working. The division between the haves and have nots is getting greater. Mm-hmm. My work focuses on creating the healthiest human beings of wealth that we can possibly have. And through that process, then those individuals understand and be able to use their wealth in ways that benefit them, the people they love, and the planet that they live on.
Yeah. And surely rejecting the wealth game is just playing another game, which is the status game. You're trying to bring someone down to increase your status in the tribe. Is that what's happening? Is that the dynamic?
It's really value signaling. It's saying that I'm a better person because I'm more compassionate and I'm more of a humanist than you, which I don't get that. Because what you tell me that my work is superfluous and you know, like no, that's not the case.
Well, it's pretty dehumanizing to the people that you're working with if they say it's superfluous, because these are real human beings with real problems. And how do these problems differ between the ultra-rich and the quote-unquote normal people? What are the differences in problems that these people face?
I think that the two main differences is intensity and scale. So the issues that arise, so say, for instance, a person who's worth, I don't know, let's just say 200 million euros suffers from depression. The intensity of that is larger because on the one hand, there's, in addition to suffering from the depression, they're also dealing with the dominant cultural message that if you have all this money, then you should be able to buy yourself out of any problems. Or you shouldn't have these problems, right? Because we live in, if I ask you, fill in the blank, money equals blank, tell me, go ahead, top of brain. You're a clever
student. It's happiness. It said happiness.
Exactly. That's exactly right. So if we think top of brain, money equals blank, money equals happiness, money equals freedom, and money equals power. And yeah, that can happen, but nothing is 100% one way. There's a duality. And so then if I'm worth 200 million euros and I'm depressed, then all of a sudden I've internalized this message that I'm really screwed up because I have all this money and I'm not happy and I can't use this money in a productive way to get me out of happiness. And by the way, the most expensive clinical care is not the best clinical care. That I've learned through my experience too. So anybody who's looking for, do not base it on the price of the care, base it on the quality of the clinicians and their understanding of these particular issues. And so that's it. So there, it becomes more intense. And the impact that mental health disorder has, it impact because there are so many people dependent upon them that they live in these systems that the negative impact of that, the scale gets increased to it impacts so many people, many more people than on the other side of the economic bell curve.
Mm. And are these ultra successful, high net worth people driven more by demons, fear, insecurities than they are positivity?
I would say that they're driven by physiological issues. So there's genetic, there's a neurochemical, like depression, anxiety. There's a biological component here, and we need to look at the science, right? We need to take these issues out of the realm of personal agency and morality, and we need to put them how they arise, and they arise in our bodies, and they arise in our neurochemical, right? And it's not all one thing, but we need to address that, and then we need to look at, you know, addressing a behavioral health issue, addressing a personality disorder, narcissism. Well, now narcissism isn't necessarily genetically predisposed. It's more environmental. But if a depressive disorder, right, we need to look at the science. We need to look at the medical interventions. And then we need to look at the context. And I address mental health issues in three significant areas of our life. The intrapersonally, like what's happening under my skin. Interpersonally, like what are the primary relationships in my life that are impacting this? And then social culturally, like what's the social cultural message? Because we all exist. Everything exists in a context. And so I think that that's how we need to address it in those particular issues.
Mm. And what percentage of our behaviors and our success and our life is determined by our genetics, do you think, just from a gut instinct reaction? Because I mean, I think Jeff Bezos said, we don't choose our passions choose us. But like, I'm just so fascinated by the genetics of how certain genes can influence your behavior and make you more obsessive, more focused, less depressive. And what percentage do you think it is influenced by?
So fluctuating between 30, 70 and 50, 50, I'm going to hedge and I'm going to do 50, 50.
Yeah.
Because basically we could be genetically predisposed to alcoholism. Mm-hmm. If we never consume alcohol, then that gene will never be activated. Mm-hmm. So it's important to look at that. It's always important to look at, I'm a family therapist, so I was trained systemically and as a family therapist. So we need to look intergenerationally. We need to look at genetics. We need to look at biology. We need to look at intergenerational trauma. We need to look at all of those things. And you know, historically, what family genogram is called, where you look at your family, the history of your family. And historically, clinicians have looked at mental health disorders. And then I like to look at money, like how has money played out in your family? So if I look at my family, my great-grandfather came over from Germany to America. Started business, lost businesses. My grandfather was an alcoholic, same thing, would have it. So my father then internalized incredible financial insecurity. And so he became obsessed with obtaining financial security in his life. And he passed that down to my brother and me. And so the decisions that I made early on my developmental path were based upon this narrative of scarcity.
Mm-hmm.
That there's not enough. It's a much different way you orient your life much differently if you internalize a message of scarcity than abundance.
Yeah.
And so whilst my family, we had emotional, I don't know whether you had emotional abundance, but we had more emotional stability than we had financial stability. So a lot of the patients who I work with, the opposite is the case.
Mm.
They come from this profound emotional financial abundance, but emotional scarcity. And so then they live their life because human beings, we are self-actualizing. We are pulled to heal and grow. That's who that's kind of how we're genetic. It's Darwinistic, right? Survival of the fittest. It's not the strongest species that survive. It's the most clever. It's the ones who can figure out how to be, you know, safe and secure in the world, essentially. And that plays out. And that's why I always want to know, like, I always want to look at family history in terms of how wealth has been created and lost and how wealth is viewed in families. I don't know, I'm going to ask you, I'm going to put you on the spot again. How is wealth viewed in your family?
Not in abundance, very scarce. Parents came from working class families. My grandparents, they were very working class. Like every single one of them came from working class.
Right.
I think they moved down from the north of England to come to mine, actually, on one of my mum's dad's side. And then my parents still grew up working class, but then both actually achieved master's degrees. But not, again, it's the same with you. The emotional stability is definitely there. Like, I have such an emotionally stable family. I absolutely love my parents, and I have no trauma there, as far as I'm aware. And but the money, in comparison to the emotional stability, is definitely scarcer. And, you know, a lot of members in my family reject wealth, to be honest. I won't obviously name names because, you know, it doesn't matter. But yeah, but I've gone the opposite direction. So when I think this is quite common, when you're a teenager, you love to be very almost virtue signaling and more rejecting capitalism or becoming a bit more socialist. But over time, as I've branched out and become my own person, I've realized the benefit of building wealth. And yeah, I think having a granddad, my granddad on my mum's side, he was very entrepreneurial. So maybe there's some genetic components as well. But there's definitely a fundamental difference between how a lot of my family see wealth and grew up in relation to wealth, their relationship with money, versus how I want to have a relationship and build wealth, for sure. Hey guys, first of all, I want to say thank you. There's one person who's been sharing the podcast more than anybody else, and that is you. The only reason why this podcast continues to grow is because you are sharing it. And my only ask is, if this podcast has provided value to you, or you think it'll provide value to somebody else, then if you could send them a DM of the link or a screenshot to the show, that would genuinely make my day. And it's the only way the podcast will continue to grow. That's my only ask of you. Thank you very much.
It's there, right? And I think a lot of people tend to ignore and pretend that it's not there. And I think my work, like, let's put this in the fore, like, because this is real and this impacts. And, you know, and you mentioned value signaling, which is a really important construct here, because if we look at how wealth has been viewed biblically, historically, you know, there's language all over the New Testament and the Old Testament in terms of, it's easier for, what is it, a camel to get through an eye of a needle than a rich man into heaven. We look at even Eastern philosophies, the Buddha. The Buddha came from a privileged noble family and tried asceticism, and it didn't work in the middle road, which is consistent with like the middle class. And so he had to relinquish his position of power and wealth to attain enlightenment. And I think that we have internalized that and we believe that. And I don't believe that. I believe that you can have wealth and you can be a person of value and dignity and add value back to the world. And that's what my work strives to do. Now, mind you, my sample size, I mean, people come to me because that's what they want to do. That's what they want to accomplish. They come to me and they say, Dr. Paul, I have all this money and yet I'm miserable and unhappy and it's destroying me. And how can I get ahead of this? How can I, without giving it away, right? I mean, like giving some of it, but not relinquishing it, right? Because that's that all or nothing mentality, and you don't need to purge it from your life. You can integrate it into your psyche and your relationships in your life in a healthy, productive way. There's two relevant constructs from psychology: assimilation and accommodation. Accommodation is where you have, for instance, I have a patient, I've had patients who've inherited huge sums of money, didn't know that they were going to do this, and they see themselves as a physician. That's their primary identity. And now all of a sudden they're an heiress and they're like, Well, wait a minute. I didn't plan for this. And my perception of an heiress is not me because I put myself through medical school and I didn't, you know, like all of this stuff. And so how do then we then accommodate that identity? And then how do we assimilate that into their larger identity in a healthy, constructive way?
Mm. And how do you think comparison and relativity plays a role in your relationship with emotional stability and wealth? Because just going back to my childhood, we were pretty low middle class. We weren't working class, but my mum and my dad made sure that I had the opportunities, even if they couldn't necessarily afford it. And I was always trying to put in the best schools and, you know, got a tutor so I could get into the good school and stuff. And that made me exposed to people who had way bigger houses than me and parents that were surgeons and stuff. And that probably does play a part, right? That comparison and that relativity, because compared to the rest of the world, almost everyone, or not almost, but a lot of people living in the US and the UK are in the top at least 10% of wealth. But is it that comparative nature that can still lead to insecurities?
Absolutely. So again, this is biological. We are human. We forget human being because we dress up well and we wear smart clothes to interviews. we're primal, right? And we're hunter-gatherers.
Yeah.
And hunter-gatherers determine their place and their security in the world in comparison to other hunter-gatherers. So if I have 2 rabbits and you have 5 rabbits, you're better off, right? And if I have 5 rabbits and you have 7 rabbits, now then you're better off. And so it's hardwired into us. And so we always are, and we're social creatures, and we're herd animals, we're tribal. And so finding our tribe, and what is a tribe? A tribe is a group of people who orient themselves around a common interest and against a common foe. And so if you add the fact that we're hunter-gatherers and we're tribal, then we're always looking over the fence. We're always looking to see, determine how well we're doing in comparison to other people.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that now because, you know, when I was coming up, like if you were a millionaire, that was a big deal. Now, forget it. You know, you're like, everyone talks about a billion. He's a billionaire. She's a billionaire and all that. And so it's that sort of thing. And then feeling, and some people too. I mean, like I have people who legitimately feel like if they say, I have enough, then they will become the hole in the donut. They will lose their reason to exist in the world because they have been so driven to achieve and accomplish and acquire that this notion of enough feels as though it's almost akin to death. Like they will lose their drive and they're ambitious. And then like, why would I get up? You know what I mean? Like it's been their whole reason to be in the world. So,
It's that fear of insufficiency, almost fear of not being enough. And then I think there's that. And then like an entrepreneur online says there's three things that a successful person or old successful person or high net worth individual has. And it's fear of insufficiency, lack of impulse control, and superiority complex. Is that what you've noticed with your clients?
Run those by me again. Superiority complex.
Yeah, superiority complex. Crippling sense
right.
of insufficiency and impulse control.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I don't know if that's necessarily the case. I mean, I think that for me, the people who I work with, the driving factors for them are they want peace of mind and sense of place.
Mm.
Now, mind you, I'm a clinician. I'm a therapist. People are not coming to me so that I can tell them how to make the next $1 billion.
Yeah.
People are coming to me so that they can find peace of mind and sense of place. So I think perhaps I'm dealing with kind of a skewed population. And the people who come to me see their wealth more as a problem than an effort, like more of more of a problem to be addressed. Yeah. So, and by the way, right, narcissists, you kind of like this inferiority, this sense of superiority that you mentioned about. That's a trait of a grandiose narcissist.
Mm.
Grandiose narcissists don't do well in the therapeutic relationship. It's like they're just not built for it.
How come?
In a number of ways. The whole personality type is they feel they have to dominate. They have to feel superior. Vulnerability is not something that they see as an asset. They need to be the smartest person in the room. So they just aren't built for it. Just interrelationally for talk therapy. So we're talking about talk therapy. Now, there are clinical interventions that are appropriate. So talk therapy, I believe, is just one part of a complete therapeutic intervention. I always recommend my patients do supplemental therapy. I'm a huge advocate of acupuncture, yoga, physicalizing, right? Doing some sort of physical Pilates, those sorts of things. So narcissistic patients will respond better to those sorts of interventions to help take the edge off. But narcissism is so deeply ingrained and it doesn't suit itself to interrelational therapies.
I've read that narcissistic traits have increased 30% or more in American college students since the 1980s. Yep. Why is that happening, and how can it be a bad thing, and what are the causes of narcissistic personality disorder?
There's two different types of narcissistic personality disorder. There's grandiose and there's covert. So grandiose is who we typically think about, the belligerent, condescending, arrogant, who is just kind of obnoxious, basically. Then there's the other side, the covert narcissists, who are manipulative. They're constantly the victim. Everyone's broken but them. They're highly manipulative. They use emotions. They cry when they, you know what I mean? Like they use their emotions. But it's all about them and it's all about manipulation. And for really, the core of narcissism is the need to constantly be in control and to exert power, because vulnerability is not, they have been severely, somebody whose care and protection they needed betrayed them early in life.
Mm.
Big B, little B, doesn't matter. This is where sort of the nature nurture thing comes in. Like, I can genetic predisposition. The message, because human beings are adaptive, Darwinism, they learn that I'm never going to do that again. I'm never going to allow myself to be vulnerable. I'm always going to be in control, and I'm always going to have power to assert over relationships. And so it's a highly adaptive strategy.
Mm.
All these things occur on a spectrum, right? So there's adaptive narcissism and then there's pathological narcissism. And we're seeing a lot more pathological and malignant narcissism in our society, in our world, on the global stage in particular, in terms of the malignant use of power and the Machiavellian tactics and the antisocial, the disregard for human life.
Mm.
That we're seeing, and there's no moral compass, that it's power for power's sake. And that's the end game and that's the goal. And so why do I think that it has risen? I think that because we've had a breakdown in communities, I think both parents having to go out into the workforce and work has happened, you know. What's important for women to be out in the workforce working, we never really considered childcare in that equation.
Exactly.
And so I think that, and so we have attachment disorders. A lot of attachment work came out of Britain after the World Wars, where we looked at children who had been separated from their parents and how that has really impacted their ability to engage in relationships and have meaningful relationships. And I think the same way, I think that the internet, I think social media in particular, social media is not about, it's not social, it's broadcast journalism is what it is, and it's broadcasting how much better you are than somebody else. And it's this, and it lacks depth. You know, I look at the Instagram and it's the same person doing the same shtick over and over and over again. And there's no depth. It's all veneer. It's all substance. It's all repetition. I blame a lot of that. I'm also starting to look at AI, and I think that AI has really taken the creativity out of the media, out of what we produce. You know, like I have now AI on my computer, and when I write, it changes. Like if I want to say something that I think is particularly clever and artistic, AI will take that away and dumb it down. Mm-hmm. And so I think that, so I think it's just a combination of things. I think AI is part of the reason why we're seeing an increase in authoritarian regimes, that sort of people are feeling out of control and the breakdown of gatekeepers. I think there's value in breaking down gatekeepers. I think there's huge value. At the same time, I think that there's also, everything is a yin and a yang. Mm-hmm. There's a positive and a negative. And so I think in the breakdown of the gatekeepers, you just have, it's like a free-for-all.
Yeah.
And when an authoritarian comes into power and says, I will fix this for you, daddy is home. I never cared for daddy, but a lot of people quite do. And so now when you have an authoritarian saying, I will fix this, I will make this better, people are greatly relieved in that because they feel so out of control because everything's spinning so fast.
Yeah. And what is the difference between narcissism and self-confidence and self-love?
So self-love and self-confidence has an altruistic component to it. So I can love myself and I can care for myself because I want to be better in relationships and I want to be better in the world.
Mm.
Where narcissism is being better for the sake of being better, for the sake of remaining separate and superior to you. And I think that in self-care, there's an element of humility that's lacking in narcissism. So in self-care, you have humility. In narcissism, you have hubris. And we know what happened to Icarus, don't we? He flew so close to the sun and his wings melted and he crashed.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Yeah. And what are the small signs that you can pick up on to tell if someone's a psychopath or a narcissist?
Well, they're quite different. I mean, so a psychopath is somebody who has a flagrant disregard for anybody but themselves and will do anything to get what they want. A narcissist is a person who really makes you feel diminished.
Mm-hmm.
And who kind of makes you kind of scratch your head like, really? Like, what was that? And so I think that does it. And we look for these are patterns of behaviors, right? I mean, a person just doesn't spring up at 30 and become narcissistic.
Yeah.
I mean, the character is revealed over time, and it's also revealed in moments of stress. So when there's a stressful moment, when there's an emotion, you know, like when there's a flare up in a relationship, that's when a person's true character comes out. And so if in those moments we see a person's true colors, essentially, is what happens.
Yeah. And I know someone, I've interacted with someone, won't say where because it might reveal who they are if they're listening.
Well, we are, Joe.
Yeah. When I speak to them, they often have, like, when I look in their eyes, there's no expression and it's empty. And they often force a laugh or a smile. And there's some small signs, but what could that indicate about that person from your experience? Because it's happened repeatedly. I've repeatedly experienced that interaction.
It could be a number of things. I mean, they could be autistic. There could be an element of autism associated with it, which is a genetic component. I mean, it's just a neurophysiological component. They could be thinking constantly, like self-absorbed in themselves and thinking about how what you're saying is impacting them. Like the filter through which they run information is them, is like me centered.
Mm.
So it could be those two things.
And what can you do to tell someone it trying to manipulate you or trying to take advantage of you and they're trying to do it subtly? What are some telltale signs? What are some red flags in relationships or in friendships with these masculine?
How you feel? I mean, we have to trust our, you know, our instincts, you know, the connection now that we know, like our gut biome and our brain, and, you know, like our gut is our second brain. And I feel my emotions in my stomach. Like I always feel a sense of angst. And I think we have to trust those feelings. And when we feel a sense of angst, it's because we're in an unsafe environment, that this just doesn't feel right. And this doesn't feel safe, and we need to pay attention to it. And then we have to look for patterns. And we have to sort of look at optimism bias, right? Which tells us, oh, no, they're not. They're fine. This isn't. They're good people. They would never do X, Y, or Z. And so that's where looking at patterns. But I think trusting your judgment and thinking, like, no, that's not right. That just, something just not, something doesn't really add up here. And trusting that. Mm-hmm. Trusting self. Because one thing we know about narcissistic people is they're manipulators. There's three tactics that they use. The three main tactics are the narcissistic cycle of abuse, where they feel threatened, they act out in anger, and then they become the victim. How dare you do that to me? And then by becoming the victim, it throws you off, right? And now all of a sudden, you're like a perpetrator, and you're like, wait a minute, I was just sort of asking to borrow the keys to the car. Like, how am I a perpetrator? And then the second one is gaslighting, where they tell you that your perception is wrong. No, you don't feel that. That's not what you feel. You feel this. Well, no, I feel that. And then the second one is love bombing, right?
Yeah.
The third one, I'm sorry, is love bombing, where, oh, I'm so sorry, you know, blah, blah, blah. Mea culpa, I'm so sorry, I'll never do that again. And then 15 minutes later, here we are.
Does that all come from a place of crippling insecurity? And is it low self-worth as well? What are the deeper feelings behind the behavior?
I think that it's a function of feeling out of control. I think it's a power struggle. I think it's not liking, needing to be in control, needing to feel powerful. I think it can be a sense of low self-esteem, low self-concept. Self-esteem and self-concept are different. Self-concept is more about who I am in the world, and if I am deficient and live in a place of scarcity. But it also can come from overindulgence. Like, you know, there were generations of kids who got trophies just for showing up. I never got a trophy. I'm kind of glad I didn't, actually.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's like, you're the best, you're the most beautiful, you're the smartest. If they're told that, then that's what they internalize. So it's a dangerous, that's a dangerous way to go too.
Yeah. Then another dangerous counter reaction to that is what I've experienced and what the UK experiences, where there's baked in cynicism. So you don't, the tallest poppy is the first one to get cut down, crabs in a bucket mentality. And, you know, it definitely makes it harder to try and stand out. And it definitely gives you it can give you lower self-esteem and give you anxiety and a really heavy like in-group, out-group bias. And you have to almost reverse engineer it or give yourself a stack of proof that that isn't the case. Because, you know, I've grown up just everyone taking the piss out of each other and a lot of people putting you down, a lot of older people putting you down. So it's almost like two sides of the, it's like a barbell strategy. It's like two sides of the spectrum, really, where a lot of the time in America, maybe people are praised too much, but then in Britain, it's the opposite.
Cultural. This is where we get back to the importance of culture and context. And this is where we can also get back. The Greeks were quite clever, weren't they? And we can go back to our friend Icarus. And so we always think of Icarus, the tale is he flew too close to the sun. But they also, the second bit of that is that he didn't want to fly too low to the marsh, because then his wings would get saturated by moisture and he would crouch. So it's finding that middle ground, right? Which is, now I'm thinking again of the Buddha in terms of the middle road and all of that. And I think that there is this titration of humility and hubris. And so being able to realize that remain teachable is important. And then I always think that, like, I'm always living in a state of existential crises. It's kind of motivated my life. And for me, the question is always why? Mm-hmm. Like, why am I doing this, right? Like, why are we having this conversation? Like, we're having this conversation so hopefully we can engage in some meaningful dialogue. And like I said to you in the beginning, I'd much prefer to talk with as opposed to at somebody. Mm-hmm. And explore these issues, which I think, and so there's a value, there's a why we're doing this. Like, I'm not doing this so that I'll get a million likes on your YouTube channel, although maybe that would be
great. Pretty cool.
But I don't think that that's our primary motivation. That's like a secondary issue. I think that we're motivated by having a meaningful, I am learning from you and exploring these issues that are very near and dear to me. And so I think it's a titration, isn't it?
Mm.
And I think that we need to get out of these binary positions of black and white, good and bad, rich, poor, Muslim, Christian, Republican, you know what I mean? Like, it's getting to a place of like the humanity that resides below both of those, love both of those. And I think this conversation, what I hope the takeaway is it's like, what does it mean to be a human? What does it mean to be a man in this particular moment in time with all of this going on? That was why I'm doing this. That's why that was the hook for me to do this with you.
The answer tends to be somewhere in the middle, doesn't it? You know, politically, you know, in terms of personality, in terms of balancing different parts of your life together. If you focus too much on one thing, you know, you're almost building a castle made out of sand, right? And maybe that's the problem that you've seen in these ultra—
I think that's really well said. And one of the focuses of my work, and I've written about this, and is the construct of intersectionality. And it came out of gender studies. And it said that we are not like a woman, a black woman is not like a woman and then a black person. You just add those two and you get a new being. It's the intersection of those identities. And so for me, I'm a middle-aged, white, male, professional, suffers from some mental health disorders and has had some challenges in my past and has overcome them. And so it's this mélange, isn't it, of all of these identities. I'm not just a white male, right? I'm a white male who has had all of these struggles and challenges in life and struggled with identity and struggled with professions and all of these things. And so it's looking at the intersection of multiple identities and how they form a unique way of being in the world. It enables us to take people out of boxes and get out of these faulty generalizations that I'd mentioned before, that just because I'm rich, I'm mean, narcissistic, selfish, and entitled. Right?
Yeah, 100%. Should we think about death more?
Absolutely. We should think about death every day.
Mm.
We should think about it. One of my mentors is a chap by the name of Irvin Yalom, and he wrote Existential Psychotherapy, and brilliant book that I read early. And death anxiety, he talks about, and death anxiety gives meaning to life. And if I think about death every day, then it enables me to savor life and figure out how I want to, what decisions I want to make and what actions I want to take to have the most meaningful life that I can, and to recognize that this doesn't go on forever. It may in another plane, but that's above my pay grade. I can't think of the chap. Oh, Pascal. Pascal is a mathematician, and Pascal's wager. He said that, you know what, by believing in God in this life, it gives me a higher quality of life. And the data show that. Like, even like if we look at the data, it shows that having a belief system, having a spiritual connection improves the quality of our life. And if I die and there's no God, well, then I've had a better life. I'll make that bet. And so that's the bet that I have. And I think about death every single, multiple times a day.
I was in the sauna last night and someone asked me, what was the biggest thing you've learned from the podcast so far, the biggest thing that you've learned so far? And I was like, the people that are going to, that are stopping you from doing the thing that you want to do because you're scared of their judgment are going to die in 100 years and be forgotten about in 3 generations. And you're going to die and be forgotten about in 3 generations. So don't stop doing what you want to do from because of the judgment of others. And it was received okay. There are other people in the sauna. I feel like I had to be honest with them because it's just like, imagine if you stayed a lawyer because you were scared of your dad's judgment.
Right.
Imagine if I didn't do the podcast because I would get a few mean comments online. Reframing it and remembering that these people don't matter right now, but they're not even going to turn up to your funeral, gives you a sense of freedom.
Yep. That's exactly right. And recognizing that because you've got a negative reaction to it, you touched something in them and you made them feel alive.
Definitely. You said judgment's part of every piece of work on a previous interview.
Yep.
Why is that the case?
Because if you're in a creative process, there is judgment inherent in that. Every piece, like people were like, and it's built into it, right? So you're going to post this and people will be liking this or just, I mean, this is like hard baked into that, right? Like I bake a chicken and I ask my spouse, how's the chicken? Is the chicken good? So, or because any act of creation, you're creating something new. And so it's going to be judged. Mm. It's just part of that process.
Mm. How, well, I've given my take on how to deal with it, but how would you deal with judgment and criticism and hate?
I'm an empath, so I take it in and it hurts.
Mm.
And then I allow myself time to recalibrate. And I make a deal. I've kind of made a deal with myself to say that I do not want to be that person who doesn't feel. That part of my sensitivity and part of the fact that I do care what other people think gives value to my work as a clinician.
Mm-hmm.
And it gives value to my work in my family, in my marriage, in my community, and all of that. I've gotten better. I do journaling where I kind of try to change my brain by saying, I don't care what other people think of me. I don't care what other people think of me. So that it doesn't really hit as hard. And I have gotten better. And I think sort of doing that exercise has enabled me to take chances, putting things out there. My book, Fragile Power, that's really huge. You know, putting her out, consider her my daughter. I can call her Franny. And I don't want her to get all tarted up. I want her to go to a good uni and get launched into the world. It is extraordinarily vulnerable. Putting that out there. And I'm sure these are vulnerable for you, or like putting this out into the world. And this is where the why comes in, right? This is where Nietzsche said, you know, men can endure any how if there's a why.
Yes.
And so understanding, it's mostly attributed to Viktor Frankl.
Yeah.
Which is a brilliant book, by the way.
Very good book.
I mean, you've probably read it. And I think that's been a very influential book in my life. But for like understanding why I'm doing something, understanding why I put Fragile Power out into the world, understanding why I have an Instagram account, understanding why I have a LinkedIn account, and why I post on there keeps me grounded. In me and my motivation, and it requires me to continually to check my motivations.
Mm. Is that through journaling? What does that look like, checking your motivations?
A lot of journal. I journal every morning. I have for years. It's also sort of understanding, like when I post something, to say, why am I posting this? Is it because I want people to say, oh, you look fantastic? Or is it because I want people to say, I look at your Instagram account and it's soothing and calming and it has nature? And whilst I want a little bit of A, who does it? Of course. I really am very happy. I really am doing it for B. Both feed my ego.
Yeah, definitely.
But I also think that it's sort of important to share. And part of what I post now a lot is of nature. We were talking about this earlier, is of nature. And I'm very privileged to live in a little remote ski village in rural Colorado. And it's a gift to be able to do that. And I get an enormous sense of, I have a sense, and I get what I talked about earlier, which is most of what my patients want, which is peace of mind and sense of place. And if I can share the peace of mind and sense of place I get from being in my home and in my natural environment, then I think that that's a worthy investment. That's something worth putting out into the universe.
Definitely. And very well said. I know you're tight for time. You've got some more stuff to do. So a few ending questions. What's one thing you want the audience to take away from this conversation? And what are some behaviors and actionable steps that they can take to improve their mental health?
I think peace of mind is, sense of place is important. I think that for me, I lived for many years this very itinerant life where I was banging about. I was in Europe. I had this job, as I mentioned, with Greenpeace. I was in like two different countries a week. And for me, having like a sense of place, a sense of community, is really important of like being able to going into the grocery store and knowing the cashier and just digging into where you are and creating an environment where you feel safe and secure in a world that is feeling less than safe and secure. And so I think focusing on your immediate environment is important, taking actions to do that.
Yeah. And as an example, that's literally the things I've been doing without realizing the last maybe month or two over summer. Just I go to a gym and it has a sauna with it. And I've just started going up to more people and speaking to people. And over time, if you go the same time almost every day, you meet regulars and you get to know about them, their lives. And I've made so many friends from that. And beforehand, the first, because I'm in Cornwall for university, the first 2 years, I was very much in the lonely chapter. I have a girlfriend, luckily, but I was kind of just focused on improving myself, reading, blah, blah, blah. And I just feel so much better now. I'm out of that chapter and I've connected with that sense of place. So it's definitely a step the audience should try and take for sure.
Good.
And if there's one piece of advice that you'd give to your 20-year-old self, what would it be?
Don't go to law school. Don't be so afraid.
Afraid of what?
Failure. Judgment. Coloring outside the lines.
And how can you be less afraid as a young person?
By finding your tribe. By finding people who, you don't need every day to show, you only need 3 to 5 people.
Yeah.
I would say spending less time on social media.
Yes.
I would say reading books, like paper books. I would say spending time in nature. We have so much to learn from nature, don't we?
Yeah. So much.
So much to learn. Just looking at a tree and how it grows and how it endures and how it grows and endures. That's enough right there. Don't be in such a hurry, I think. I think that's enough.
Yeah. Yeah. Very, very good advice. Dr. Hoogmeyer, ladies and gentlemen, absolutely loved this conversation. It was fantastic. And I've had to skip so many questions about dopamine, about the motivation. So I'd love to do a round 2 in the future. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. And I already know
so certainly did.
The audience will love this and learn a lot. Where can people go if they want to find your work?
Just find me on LinkedIn. I'm sure it's the best thing. My surname is Hochmeyer, Hochmeyer. There aren't many of us about. find me. Do you want to have a look at my Instagram? Do that. And just, you can just Google my surname and you'll find more than you'd ever want to know. Oh, and Perplexity, right?
Perplexity. Yeah. Well, I'll leave the links to your work and your social medias in the show notes below. Thank you for joining me.
Well, thank you.
If you want to start your own podcast, but have no idea where to start, and you want to generate viral social media clips and get your dream guests onto your show, even from just using your laptop in your bedroom like I did, then my Pro Remote Podcast Blueprint is exactly for you. It is a private paid course and community that has every single step and process I've used and continue to use to grow this show. And I include every single secret, every single tactic I do and still use that will get you results super fast. And also, if you want to access me personally every single week, then as part of this course, you'll also be able to join live weekly calls where I go through your podcast and answer your questions to get you results much, much faster. So if you want to actually start a podcast and stop dreaming and get millions of social media views and book your dream guests in half the amount of time it took me, then click the first link in the description.